Hello, I'm Joan. I'm a Canadian family physician who also works as a restorative medical educator, facilitator, and coach. I create spaces that rehumanize the work of healthcare. I'm creating this podcast to remind myself, as well as anyone else working in a helping profession, that when you are working and caring for your human patients, you are the other human in the room. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. So this week's episode is a very special episode of this podcast. I'm doing something that I haven't really done, which is, number one, my first in-person interview, where I am interviewing not one, but actually two separate people, while being in their presence. And it's a very special group of people that I am interviewing, which is members of my family. So basically the whole idea of this project just came to me randomly one day. I think about healthcare a lot. I think about what it takes to stay human in healthcare a lot. As you know, I have a whole podcast about it. And one thing I was really reflecting on for myself is the relevance of the fact that I am by far not the first physician in my family. I come from a family that has many healthcare professionals, including not just physicians, but also includes a lot of physicians. And I reflect a lot about what that was like growing up. And I started to get curious what it was like for other members of my family and their experience of being in this medical family. So this may be a standalone episode, or this may be a series. It will depend in large part if other members of my family want to be interviewed. But I didn't wait to see who else would be interested. I haven't even asked anyone else yet. Just when I had the idea, I knew who I had to start with. And that was my Uncle Jack. He's actually my great uncle. He is the identical twin of my grandfather on my mom's side. He is, as he says in this episode, the only living member of his medical class. So my grandfather passed away when I was in medical school, actually. And my grandfather was also a physician, and so is Uncle Jack. And Uncle Jack's in his late 90s. And one of the things that often comes up every time I see him at family functions is him saying, "I don't know when I'll see you again." And it was something I didn't want to wait on. Uncle Jack's in remarkably good health, considering he's in his late 90s, but you just never know. And so I thought, okay, I have to email Uncle Jack right away and ask if he wants to be on my podcast. And Uncle Jack is very savvy with the internet. He has a TikTok. He is on Facebook. He has an email. He uses his iPad all the time. And so he wrote me back right away. And so that is who I interview for the majority of this podcast. The second person that I interview is his daughter, Susan. So I think the correct term is she's my first cousin once removed, in that she's my mother's cousin, so one generation removed. She is not a physician, but she talks about also in this podcast what it was like to grow up with a physician for a father and a nurse for a mother. And when you listen to this recording, you'll hear that we're all in the same room. So when I'm interviewing one of them, the other one is like sitting in a chair behind. And so sometimes you even hear a bit of the audio of them chiming in, or you'll see me or the person I'm interviewing looking off camera at someone. That's who we're looking at, is because the three of us were sharing space together in my Uncle Jack's residence in the retirement home where he lives down in the Niagara region. And yeah, it was such a special, honestly, like pretty like profound experience to do this interview. I'm so grateful that both Susan and Uncle Jack like gave their time and were willing to be interviewed and share so freely about stories of growing up and working in medicine. I really felt a sense of connection to my own lineage that I hadn't really reflected on for some time. It was my Uncle Jack who once told me, he's like, you know, you're fifth generation physician, right? And I was like, what? I actually didn't know that physicians went that far back in this, in our family. And hearing Uncle Jack recount who those people were and sharing more of their story, including parts of the story that I've either never heard or heard at a time in my life when I was younger, where I didn't really have the interest and context to actually take note. I just feel very, very grateful to even just have heard those stories, and especially to have those stories captured, knowing that, I mean, no one lives forever. And the fact that however long all the people I interview on this podcast live, it's really special that we have now this recorded document of some of these stories that are like living history. I just feel so lucky to have had the opportunity to hear those stories and capture them for others to hear. I thought a lot about what kind of questions I wanted to ask. I think it's important to sort of name my intention with this particular episode, and moving forward, if there are other episodes that are also my medical family episodes, my intention's not to like reveal the dirt or the secrets or like the private stories of my family. You'll hear potentially more editing in this episode than in other episodes where I usually almost never edit. And part of that's just for time, but also, you know, sometimes people's names would be named, and I'm just respectful of the names I think aren't necessary in order to still tell the story. So you'll hear some more editing that way. I thought it would be really interesting to kind of humanize, through specific humans telling their stories, like humanize the evolution of medicine through the generations and the themes that come up from that, including things like Uncle Jack has experienced things that I will never experience or see, in terms of the culture of the hospitals when, like, he was at SickKids in Toronto when it was like a new hospital. Certainly even the social environment, the time in history in which he grew up, like just the, what was going on in society at those times, that's different than what I grew up in and what I'm experiencing today. The diseases he saw, like he gets a little bit into that, but like literally there were diseases that he saw that have been either eradicated or certainly become way less prevalent through, you know, wonderful innovations in technology, like vaccines for sure. And as a result, there's times where he's sharing, you know, his opinion about something to do with healthcare or medicine. That's his perspective and his opinion that isn't quite the same as mine. But doesn't that make sense? Like, in that he has had a whole different life experience than me. And I thought that was interesting also to sort of share. And I invite you to kind of reflect on the history of the time that you're in now, both because it's interesting in my opinion, but also I have a hope that it would help folks to not feel like the way things are now are the way things have to be forever. Something really interesting, you know, only two generations on, medicine is very different. And there's ways in which I think most of us would agree it's not doing well. There's ways in which maybe some of us would think things are getting better and others wouldn't, like depending on your perspective. But no matter what, I think one lesson that I want to offer to you, sort of a takeaway even before we jump into the episode, is that healthcare, the practice of medicine and the system of healthcare, is always a dynamic and living and changing thing. And so if you're feeling stuck in the way things are now, there's always opportunity to change, whether you want to be a part of like wide system change or even just like knowing there very much isn't just one way to do anything. And so if you don't like how it's going for you, what if you took it upon yourself to shift things and how they're going for you within even your corner of healthcare? And that's what this entire podcast is about. So if that's of interest to you, feel free to listen to past episodes about that. But for this one, I wanted to share this sort of these personal family stories with you in hopes that they're interesting, perhaps inspiring. I ask them both to offer advice to everyone about what they would want to share with people who are struggling or feeling burnt out in healthcare, and they give some really lovely answers. And in some ways, it's a way to get to know me more. So if you're interested in my history and my lineage, my medical lineage, I invite you to listen in. So you'll hear first the Uncle Jack interview, and then it will cut over to Susan's interview. And then at the end, I'm going to chat a bit about some takeaways that I had after reviewing it myself. The last thing to say is that audio-wise, I just had the one microphone. So I've tried to keep the parts where I'm talking off mic short, because they're very quiet, but I hope you can hear them well enough. So thanks for your patience with that. I am early in my journey as an audio engineer. I am learning experientially as I go. All right, so now on to the interviews with Dr. John Blake Dobson, who I call my Uncle Jack, and with Susan Dobson. Well, hello.
Hello to you too.
Can you start by introducing yourself and sharing how do we know each other?
You are my great niece, the daughter or the granddaughter of my identical twin brother, Bill. He was a doctor as well.
And what's your name?
Mine's John Blake Dobson, MD, FRCP.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And actually, what kind of doctor are you? Were you like what specialty?
Well, I was a pediatrician. I got my training at Sick Children's Hospital. That's right. But before that, I did a junior internship at St. Joseph's Hospital in Toronto, and at that time I realized I wanted to be a pediatrician because I love being with kids, and I didn't want to be treating old people.
They're so boring, right? How did you know you wanted to become a doctor?
Oh, I wanted to become a doctor from the time I was at least 5 years old, because every summer, we used to go up and visit my grandfather, my mother's dad, Dr. William Glaister, in Wellesley, Ontario. And we used to go up, and had the Glaister farm was up there too, and we used to go in there in the summertime. And we used to make house calls out in the country with my granddad, and he would talk to us on the way out to make house calls. And I always thought, oh, if I could only be a doctor anywhere near as good as he is, because I thought he was the best doctor in the world. He was a very wise man. He graduated with a gold medal of his class in Trinity College in Toronto, and then came to Wellesley to work with Dr. Morton, who was my great-great-grandfather. He was a doctor from Ireland, and he had three daughters, Grace, Lillian, Louise, and Gwen. And granddaddy, my Dr. Glaister, married one of the daughters of Dr. Morton, and that was Grace. And when my mother was 3 years old, her mother died of tuberculosis. It was a terrible blow to my grandfather. He diagnosed that actually by taking a smear from her sputum in the very office where we used to go and visit. And it was quite a blow. But he waited 10 years before he got married again. And then he married his wife's sister, Louise, yeah. And Louise was a nurse trained in Brooklyn, New York. She then was my grandmother and mother, my mother's aunt, really, and mother, stepmother, yeah. And I always wanted to be a doctor. Learning all about the human body and the sicknesses and all this fascinated me. And I couldn't have been anything else except a bank robber.
We have to have a backup.
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a backup.
Do you know if Bill, you're like my grandfather, was it similar? Do you guys talk about that? Like you both wanted to be doctors?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Bill, well, we did everything together. We were identical twins. And Bill wanted to be a doctor, and he turned out to be a very, very good doctor. He was practiced in Vineland, Ontario. Interesting about, he was, after he graduated and did training in OBGYN, and then he decided he didn't want to do that. So he took a year off and went to Holland, and he was a doctor for the Canadian embassy there. That's where he met his wife, Shirley. She was working for the Mounted Police there. But Bill was a really good family doctor. I used to get all sorts of people saying that he was, and other doctors the same. He'd been trained in surgery doing the OBGYN course. So he was quite a good surgeon, and he did a lot of surgery till they put a stop to it because they said, if you don't have your fellowship in surgery, you don't do any surgery. Yeah. So Bill had to stop it then. Yeah.
So you and he, you got into medical school at the same time.
Oh, yes, graduated too. We both graduated cum laude. Well, it wasn't the very top of my class, but about third down. But it's interesting to know that I am the only surviving a member of the Meds 51. There used to be 60 of us, and now there's one. That's me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that we're hearing your story. Yeah. How was it going through medical training?
Oh, I loved it. I did a rotating internship at St. Joe's in Toronto, and so I went through all the different specialties. And the one I liked the best was pediatrics, is where I met my wife, Ina. She was the head nurse at St. Joe's Hospital on the pediatric ward. And she was one of the smartest nurses I ever met. She was charming, good looking, and smart as heck. But she made a wonderful wife, a wonderful mother for my kids. And so that was another one in the medical field.
Yes.
My sick children's training, I was a junior intern for my first year, and then I was a senior resident, and then I took a year of a fellowship in bacteriology and pathology, and so that was interesting, because the only trouble is I had to get up in the middle of the night and identify spinal fluids for Haemophilus influenza mostly, you get in children. And I also did a lot of autopsies too, which I really didn't like too much. But, it was very interesting. I did a lot of microscopic work too. And I really enjoyed that part of pathology.
Yeah. But you did, in your practice, you didn't focus on pathology, right?
Like, no. Yeah. Just, I was a general practice in pediatrics. I looked after kids from birth right up to, usually until they were about, well, when the girls started menstruating, usually they left and went to a general practitioner.
Yeah.
That was about 12 or 13. But there were some exceptions. The ones that didn't want to go to any other doctor. Yeah. So I looked after a couple of them until they were about 25. I loved the work at Sick Kids. It was just a new hospital at the time, and all the people that I worked with at the hospital were great people to work with. They were brilliant people. As a matter of fact, one of the things about medicine, talk about going to change medicine or. One of the things that I have seen in the big change in medicine is the fact that about 70% of the classes are women now. And I think that's really great because women are meant to look after the sick because nurses do it and nobody worries about that. And the only problem is with women in medicine, they do not do as much work as a man does because they can't, they've got children to look after, they got families and other things. So, but anyhow,
I'm actually curious about that part. I was wondering, because like nowadays, there's a lot of talk about burnout in medicine and people wanting to not, you know, stay at the hospital for 3 days at a time, 72-hour call, like some of that. Yeah. I'm wondering, at your time, though, was like, what was the, were there conversations about being stressed? Were there conversations about the physical toll of practicing medicine?
Well, we never really talked about it too much, but we could see it in our colleagues and ourselves, too, if we were, starting to get burned out because we were busy all the time. And being a pediatrician, I did a lot of house calls. And, you know, that's another thing that emergency departments here are filled up every day with people that are not emergencies. And when I first started practice, I used to make maybe 3 or 4 house calls a day. And because I did that, if I had 100 other colleagues doing the same thing, that's 300 people a day that were seen at home. And now they all go to the hospital, and actually they're told by their doctor to go to hospital too. So it's different that way. House calls were really something I liked because you could see the family dynamics. You could see the family, see what's going on. And that was the one big change in medicine, the practice of medicine.
Yeah. So, were you doing house calls right till the end of your time as a pediatrician? And then I know that you made a bit of a shift, right? Like technically you retired, but then you kept.
Sure. Well, after I retired, I was retired for about 6 months. And I met one of the doctors that I worked with, and he said, "Well, how do you like retirement, Jack?" And I said, "I hate it.
Yeah.
I got nothing to do. I don't know what to do." And he said, "Well, how about coming back and being an assistant in surgery? Because we really need them. The GPs don't come in and assist anymore. They're too busy in their office." Yeah. So I loved it. It was a great career. I did for 17 years. I was on staff of the hospital longer than anybody else. I was on 56 years from the time I started in 1955, right on.
And that was all the same hospital?
Two hospitals, the Dew and the General. I was head of the pediatric department at the Hotel Dew, and it was a lovely hospital. Different atmosphere altogether.
And did you did inpatient then as well as outpatient?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I would go to every morning, make calls, go to the General, and see my 4 or 5 patients I had in the hospital. And then I go over to the Dew, and I maybe have 4 or 5 patients in the hospital there. Oh yeah, sure. We did a lot of work right in the hospital. Sure.
I wonder. I know one thing that can be hard. That still, even like myself and my colleagues, like we find it hard to take time to also just have our own lives. Like there's pressure not to take vacation. What happens when you get sick? Did you find it easy to take vacation if there were times you were unwell?
I wouldn't have taken a holiday except for my wife. Okay. She'd say, I'm going to Scotland. If you want to come, you can come. And so that's what I'd do. And we every trip we had, almost, she did all the booking and then I'd have to take the time off because I was a workaholic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, I did have, it did wear me out in the fact that I became mentally ill. I was very badly depressed after about, 20 years of practice, I guess. But I overcame that and got the right medication. I've been fine and relatively happy life. My kids have been good to me. And I couldn't ask for a nicer daughter than Susan. She does everything for me.
And you'd say that even if she wasn't in the room, right?
What? Oh, she in the room?
Behind the camera.
Oh, that's who that is.
That's Susan, remember?
Yeah.
What did...
I want to say, people ask me, Jack, what was the most spectacular thing that happened to you during your practice? And I say, without a doubt, the polio vaccine. It came in 1955, just the year that I started practice. We never saw a case of polio after the vaccination. Never saw another one. Had one that I thought might be, had all the symptoms of it, but I sent out a sick kids, and it turned out to be a herpes.
Oh,
yeah. Cool. And it did the same as polio, too. But anyhow, no, that was the one of the most spectacular thing to see a vaccine come in like that and wipe out the disease completely. And in Canada, anyways, I know they had a lot of it in Africa. And Bill Gates spent millions or billions of dollars trying to eradicate it. It's amazing now that we're seeing these diseases that are coming back, like whooping cough. Whooping cough used to be the commonest cause of death in infants and children about 70 years ago.
Yeah.
But with the vaccine, no. I'm sure there are many doctors that have never seen a case of measles, red measles.
I've never seen measles.
Yeah. And it was so common, you could make the diagnosis so easily, you just opened their mouth and looked inside their mouth, and on the buccal membrane inside the mouth, there was these little white spots, which was pathognomonic of my reason of the measles. Now, the German measles didn't have any sign like that, but it was easy to diagnose because it was a mild measles, and it was a generalized rash that wasn't this itchy.
Another thing that we talk about a lot is work-life balance. What did you like to do sort of for fun outside of medicine, or how did you keep things fun even inside medicine?
I was crazy about sailing, and I had a sailboat, many sailboats. I just loved being on the water. Probably got that from my great-grandfather on my Dobson side. He was he came from Isle of Lewis up in the North Sea off Scotland there, and he was a fisherman. And in those days, they didn't have any motor, so I'm sure he was sailing. And then he immigrated to Canada and settled in Southampton. And he started a fishing fleet there. And he's buried up in Port Elgin, which is just a suburb, really, of Southampton. So I think that's where I must have got the love of water. But it's funny, my twin brother really didn't care too much for it. He bought himself a catamaran because it would go fast. But I loved
flying, right? I loved
racing. We raced everywhere in the Sea Knight, and we won a lot of trophies.
Oh, racing in your car?
Yeah, racing in my
sailboat.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Well, I wasn't crazy about cars like Bill was.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
grandpa. Yeah. He had a Mercedes SL300. That model, if he had it today, if he kept it, probably worth $2 or $3 million.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's fun. And I guess that's connected to, you know, something that I think about a lot is that there's sort of this ironic thing, like we're the people that take care of the other humans, but often our jobs, because maybe we're workaholics or whatever, we forget that we're human.
Mm.
And I wonder, when you were going through your career, what helped you stay connected to your humanity?
Oh, my faith.
Your faith.
Yeah, my faith. I had a very strong faith.
And how did that help you stay connected?
Well, it gave me a feel of some worth that I was... A good person doing God's work.
Yeah.
And I think that's mostly. Well, I got relaxation from my sailing too. But,
yeah. Wonderful. And so, as you're well aware, you are from a line of physicians.
Yeah.
And also, even still living, this family of ours is full of doctors.
Oh.
And that's kind of what this whole project's about, is like, what's it like being
It was lovely. My great grandfather, Dr. Morton,
yes.
he graduated. He was Irish, came from Ireland, and moved to Scotland. But he, and then he has one of his daughter, Grace, was Dr. Morton's daughter, married Dr. Glaister.
Right.
And that's where what really started, because after Dr. Glaister, that was my mother's father. He had two daughters, Deborah, And then my mom, Helen, and when he married his wife that died, sister,
yes.
Then he had another child named Deborah. She was a beautiful girl, and she became a doctor in the days when there was almost no women in medicine.
Yeah.
I think it was she graduated in 1923 or something like that from Toronto. And she became a very clever doctor. Worked with my grandpa for a while. And then she set up a practice in Kitchener, and looked after only females. She had no males in her practice.
So a general practitioner.
Yeah, she was a general practitioner then with women.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, then I had a son, two sons and a daughter, and one of my sons, William Glaister, William Mackenzie Dobson, became a doctor, and he was a doctor in Oakville, Ontario. Started off in Unionville, but he moved from Unionville to Oakville, had a very successful practice there. He just retired a couple of months ago, but he still got his license because he's working for the jail. That's Bill.
Yes.
Now, on my brother Bill, he was a doctor in Vineland, I told you, my identical twin brother. He had three doctors in his family. He had Barbara Jane, who did general practice in Ancaster, and then he had Crawford, and he was an orthopedic surgeon, and he's still practicing in Peterborough, and then Tracy was a doctor in town here in St. Catharines, and that was okay. That's the three doctors there. Now, then really my son, the doctor, had
one boy, one girl.
Yeah. And the girl is a nurse,
yeah.
And she's doing the same sort of work I did as a pediatrician.
Yeah.
She's head of the premature ward at Vancouver Hospital. Now, Bill's had a daughter, Janie, had a title children. And Janie had a daughter that turned out to be a very excellent daughter by the name of Joan.
Oh, I think I've heard of her.
Oh, yeah, she was a delight. And anybody's got her for their daughter, they're really lucky. I don't know whether... with all that, they've got a whole bunch of kids now, and I don't know their name. But anyhow, I'm sure one of them will become a doctor.
I think one thing that's interesting is, say, you know, at Thanksgiving or Christmas, we all get together, and I think we have interesting. I think our conversations around.
People often say to me, "What do you talk about?" I said, "What do you think we talk about? We talk about medicine."
Yeah.
And some of the things were pretty disgusting to most people,
yes.
But to our family, it was natural.
It's fine.
We would talk about any case. Yeah, that's what do you talk about? Well, we talked about medicine and maybe our trips too. You know?
Yeah.
And we were a very close family. We all loved each other, really.
Yeah.
We lost four. I lost four nephews just like the last couple of years, and it was all due to cancer. Yeah. Two of them were heavy smokers, got cancer. They came to me and said, "Uncle Jack, I got this lump on my throat here. What do you think about it?" And I said, "I felt it." And I said, "Does it hurt?" And then he said, "No." I said, "That's too bad, because it means it's cancer. Then it's a metastasis to a gland from some pathology in your mouth or head and neck." And I was right. And both of them died within a year of being diagnosed, and they were only in their 50s.
Yeah,
yeah, too bad. And then Joan's son, he died of cancer of the rectum, which was really, made me upset, because if he had called me and let me know about his symptoms, I would have had one of my confreres do him right away. His doctor told him that he would wait for about 6 months and see how things go. Well, he had a cancer was all through him by the time they opened him up.
It's hard because it doesn't save ourselves or people we love from still being
Not if it's an addiction.
Yeah.
And I never realized, and the doctors didn't either when I was first starting practice, that cigarettes were really, nicotine was such an addictive drug. And apparently it's the most addictive drug of all.
Oh, yeah.
I smoked when I was at college because it was a good thing to do.
Yes.
Everybody smoked. But I fortunately, I hated the taste in my mouth, and I didn't carry on. I never smoked very long. That's why I'm 98 now almost. If I'd smoked, I know I would have gone long ago.
Yeah.
We used to have a physiology professor named Stavraki, a little Russian guy. And he said, "You Dobsons, don't you ever smoke." Because we did a test where we inject a histamine into our skin to see how reaction. And Bill and I had a swelling from our fingernails right up to our armpit. It was serious. And so he said, "Don't you ever smoke, because you'll probably die of Verger's disease."
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that was good advice.
It was very good.
And so in your immediate family, like you had two sisters and a twin brother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of that, so you and your twin brother were the doctors.
Yeah.
And what was it like to have a twin brother who was also a doctor?
Well, it came very naturally. I mean, if I was going to be something, Bill would be too. We had the same likes pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you guys talk a lot about medicine?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk. And one thing that was very nice about having a brother that was in medicine too, we'd go out after supper and we'd go for a walk and we would quiz each other. Mm-hmm. And we knew if we didn't know the answer, we better find out what all about it. And it really helped, because geez, here on the exam, one example of that was I got the highest mark in organic chemistry. I got a 95, and our class average was 50. And then why had happened? They thought we had seen the exam. But we said, what happened was, at the back of the book of organic chemistry were different problems. And we worked through three or four of the problems. Guess what? They were on the exam.
You just studied
smart. Oh, geez. Yeah. Well, they didn't have the same numbers in it, but they changed. It was a piece of pie. I walked out of the room, and everybody's still working away. Yeah. They work for another half hour, an hour. And I thought, well, gee, I don't know what's going to happen, but I got the highest mark.
Nice.
Yeah, that was in organic chemistry, and that was in Freeman's.
So I usually ask everyone who's on the podcast, thinking about people who are working in medicine now. Actually, I think people can feel stressed. There's a lot of strain on the healthcare system now for lots of reasons. But what advice would you have for them as they're working, they're grinding it out day to day?
Well, stay true to yourself look after yourself. Make sure you're no good to anybody as a sick doctor. And so you look after yourself. You take holidays and try and stay out of trouble. Well, that's what else. Well, you got to love your work. I mean, if you don't, I feel so sorry for somebody that has a job that they hate. It would be terrible. It's a wasted life. And I could never get enough of medicine. You know, my grandfather, William Glaister, he was still, when he was about 82 or so, was still studying medicine. He had books, and he knew all the bones and the names of them and all the rest, and muscle attachments. He was just like he was at medical school.
Wow.
And the guy was 80, about 82 at that time.
Gotta love it.
He loved medicine. Loved medicine. But actually, you know, it was funny that he wasn't going to become a doctor. The Glaister farm, when his father died, it was split three ways between his brother, Joseph, and George. So they split the farm. And the granddaddy didn't get any part of it. He didn't want to be a farmer because he was so small and not very strong. He was only about 5'3", and I don't think he ever weighed more than about 100 pounds, I don't know. Yeah, but he was a spark plug. He said he thought he might be a lawyer. But his minister at his church told him, William, you are a person that gets along with everybody. You're smart. You better be a doctor. You don't be a lawyer. And so with that advice, granddad went into medicine, and he loved it. Loved it. It was amazing the stuff they did back in those days. You know, he put in his own telephone company. When he made a house call, he'd go out to Mrs. Jones there, and the lady in the next farm would need him too. So he wouldn't know he needed her. There were no telephones in. So he would come back in, and he'd find out after a right out again. So he put in a little switchboard, put on his post as a telephone post, and lines out to many parts of his practice.
He hooked it all up.
Yeah, and my mother was a switchboard operator.
Oh.
Yeah, that was really something.
That is
amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, and he sold, I guess he sold out to Bell Telephone. If we still had that stock, we'd be billionaires.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing all of those stories, Uncle Jack.
No, you want me to tell you about girlfriends?
No. Maybe next time.
Yeah, okay.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm happy to do it.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Susan Dobson, daughter of Jack Dobson.
And how do we know each other?
You are my cousin Jane's daughter, and Jane is a daughter of Dad's twin brother, Bill.
So, like, you're my genetic half aunt or genetic aunt, right?
I'm like a genetic aunt.
Yeah.
That's because your mom is my genetic half sister.
Yeah. Isn't that fun?
It's wild.
It's wild. So I'm doing this whole series talking about being from a family of doctors as a doctor myself. And you are a family member who is not a doctor. So what is it that you did for your profession?
I was an art educator.
And how did you decide? Well, did you ever think you might be a doctor? I guess that's one question. And how did you decide to be an art educator instead?
I knew I never wanted to be a doctor.
Why not?
I don't have the personality, and I don't have the science acumen. It wasn't something that I was interested in. And having my dad and mom in medicine, again, around the kitchen table, that was a lot of the discussion. But it wasn't my calling. Yeah. And when I was in high school, my first year of high school, I had an art teacher that really encouraged and inspired me. And my technical skills weren't there yet, but I had this real creative bent, and she recognized it and acknowledged that. And so I went in that direction. I also had my grandmother, my dad's mom was artistic, but on my mom's family as well, my mother's youngest brother was an artist and taught at OCAD for 35 years or so. And his wife was an artist. So it wasn't something that was totally new and different in that way. I mean, dad's mother, my grandmother, Helen, she painted, sculpted, wrote poetry, made these amazing marionette puppets, 18-string marionette puppets, and put on shows at the church. And so she was very creative and talented. And so that's sort of the direction I went.
Did you have an inclination you wanted to be an educator as well? Or was it like, was that a bit of a path, a journey to discover?
No, it was funny because my mom was trying to push me to be a nurse, and I just knew I really wasn't interested. But again, this art teacher inspired me in the sense that I wanted to inspire others the way she inspired me to love art, to create, and to learn, and that became my passion. Yeah, so I spent, I think, well, I'm still teaching, and I'm 70, so. That's one of the Dobson things that I did inherit was we don't retire.
I was going to say, because I had this misconception, it's the doctors that don't retire, and it's like a doctor thing, but now it's a Dobson thing, isn't it? So what's up with that? Why don't Dobsons know how to retire?
I knew I didn't have the energy. I taught in boarding schools, and that's a whole other animal. It's almost 24/7. I was a house mother in a boarding school, and I had 52 teenage girls that I lived with, as well as the head of the arts department at Appleby College. So that was a lot. And I knew, and it was one of those things, I didn't want to be that person that everybody's going, oh my gosh, when's she going to retire? So I retired in my late 50s, and then I moved from Oakville to Niagara-on-the-Lake, and it was like, what am I going to do now? And I was like, Dad, I think I lasted maybe 6 months. And I got involved with the art community there and started teaching classes and doing some private classes. And then I've just been developing courses, and I do art history lectures as well as teaching studio. Yeah.
You also have, like, I don't know if you consider it a caregiving component, but like you're doing like spiritual direction stuff now. Yes. Too, right? So yes. Like, it's interesting how it's still like, there's a healing bent to some of what you're doing now.
Yes. I had a friend say that to me the other day, even though you're not a physician, you know a lot. I've been immersed in it my whole life, and I'm still immersed in it. We had dinner last night and Tracy was with us, and you get into these discussions, you know, about medicine and different things. And so I've been immersed in it, and people sometimes come to me and ask me questions. It's like, no, it's not me. But in terms of, yeah, I mean, I just loved I miss the students from the young people. I do miss that. But I'm doing spiritual direction. I'm doing a course now on the Crone to look at mentoring younger people as an elder. And so, yeah. And using art, I do soul collage. I'm also a soul collage facilitator. So I'm busy.
You're doing things. And so you mentioned a bit of it, but I would love to hear, I mean, just any thoughts, any stories. What was it like growing up around so many people in the body profession, in the medicine and nursing professions? Good and bad, and everything in between.
Oh, no. Well, okay. So one of my memories is when we lived on Ridgewood, there would be a lineup outside the side door. I believe it was on Thursdays, and Dad would give the neighborhood kids their allergy shots. There's about four or five kids that would get allergy shots at least once a week, maybe. And then the other thing I remember is when I got to be in about grade four, when I could read and write. Back in those days, for the doctor, the phone would ring and there'd be a nurse's registry. And I was taught how to answer the phone.
In your house?
In the house. Yeah. I had to know how to answer the phone. I couldn't just say hello. I had to say Dr. Dobson's residence. And if that was the nurse's registry, I had to be able to put it, there was a message to write it down. So I remember that because nobody else, none of my friends had to know how to answer the phone properly. Right. And then just things like there was a boy down the street that came and swung on something in the backyard. We weren't there and he broke his leg and Dad had to deal with that. Mm. And just like people in the neighborhood would come around. Yeah. So it was always sort of part of our lives. And Mom and Dad would talk about patient, not people's names, but cases, like I had scarlet fever today and I had to, you know, that sort of thing. Dad mentioned it. He wasn't around a lot.
Yeah.
I remember the routine was he'd get up in the morning and go and make rounds at the hospital first, then go to the office. And then after the office, do house calls and would come home around 7. So by then, we were doing our home. We'd already eaten dinner and doing our homework, and Mom would have dinner waiting sort of for him. And that was just part of the whole routine. That's just what you got used to.
Right. That's when you could see him.
Yeah. And he was right. My mom would force vacations without the kids. Because I remember every winter they'd go 2 weeks to Florida or somewhere down south, sometimes with your grandfather and grandmother, and sometimes with friends. But they always took 2 weeks and we'd have a babysitter or someone stay with us to get the inside scoop. Or if we have, like you said, the big get-togethers. I do remember bringing a boyfriend home and, as you said, the conversations can get gory and bloody and whatever, and they are so oblivious. Yes. So the boyfriend comes and is turning green as they're talking about bile or something, and it just like right over their heads. Yes. They don't really get it. And I do remember being at the pillar and post because my mother's eldest brother was also a doctor. Yes, Dr. LaPierre. Yeah. He was a pediatrician as well. And Dad and he were in practice together for a number of years in partnership. And I remember when my brother Bill was in medical school and we went to the Pillar and Post for a Christmas dinner and my uncle Armand was there and Dad and Mom. And Bill was so excited because he'd been learning how to look at stool cultures, and we're sitting in the Pillar and Post and I'm listening to this going, oh, nobody else has to deal with this at Christmas dinner. Yeah. So that was, yes.
Do you think that it's impacted your view of your own health or your own body being around people that talk about health and body and like the ways that we do in medicine?
Well, the interesting thing I've discovered about with me is that I, because I know how busy my dad was and everybody else in the family, I tend to do the opposite. And it's like, I don't want to bother the doctor, which is not a good thing. And I have learned that I have to be more assertive, particularly in this healthcare time, because if I'm not pushing it, it doesn't happen. But the other thing too is, the good thing is I have backup. So if the my doctor says to me, no, I don't think, and I go, well, you know, talking to my dad, talking to my cousin, they think, you know, that I should actually get that looked at.
Yeah.
Sure, he doesn't appreciate it.
I think we all have to pull the strings we can, that's for sure. Well, and I mean, as someone who has really though shepherded a lot of people through a stressful period of their lives, which is adolescence. And I know, so I bet you have some advice about for those in healthcare, how, if they're feeling stressed, if they're feeling burnt out, what sort of advice or wisdom would you want to share with them?
With medical team? Yeah. I think the same thing that Dad said, you have to take care of yourself or you're not of any use or help to anybody else. And one thing that seems that I've seen changing is the whole team approach. Even in the medical clinic that the doctor I go to, we have nurse practitioners. There's a physiotherapy clinic right next door. There's just more and more of a team effort. An approach, which I think is healthy because people can spell each other off and they can, there's certain things that a nurse practitioner can look at that you don't need the doctor for. The team approach, I think, is a healthy direction.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down to talk with me.
Okay.
You know what my tuition was for my final year?
Hello. So this is Joan chiming in at the end of the two interviews. Thank you so much for listening. If you listened all the way to the end here. Right before I'm recording this, I just went through and like watched both interviews and edited them down and tried to distill them to like the core stories and the core messages that were shared. And I really just got chills again about the fact that this is my family and my lineage. I just think that is so, it is really interesting to reflect on where you've come from. Even if there are things about that story that feel hard or things that feel like you don't relate to them or that you don't identify the same way they do, they're still a part of you in some way. And one of my takeaways I'd offer to all of you is to reflect on your lineage, whether it's you want to do it for your family of origin, your genetic story, you know, the family that raised you that may not share genetics with you potentially, even the lineage of the places in which you work, you know, whether you work in like what kind of institution you work in, the preceptors you had, like how all of those people still like reverberate and what stories that you're holding on to now, both that you like and that you don't like, where they came from. I find that process really helpful, first of all, because it helps me to recognize that all stories I tell myself about myself and about the world are optional and we get to change them, as you've heard me say before. And also to give kind of credit to where things come from. Like, it was really interesting, like even thinking through the creative part of what I'm doing, like how much I'm enjoying being creative, whether it's through this podcast and speaking and teaching, and even through like the pleasure activism I'm doing with you know, learning Taylor Swift songs or singing, and how much that is tied to my family of origin as well, and how I did learn the appreciation of like creativity and music and things from my family as well. And, you know, as Susan was talking like about being an educator and a teacher, like those are things that I also really relate to and connect with. And so it's so special to see those that have come before me that now I am echoing what they did with their lives in some ways with my own. I just think that's really special. Talking with Uncle Jack, one of the main things that like came up for me really strongly was like how much he describes having a passion for like learning about the human body and like diagnosing diseases, something he actually said. He kept telling stories after we stopped recording, of course. And I was like, oh, we stopped recording. But like he was talking about the times where he was known as like being a very good diagnostician, both him and my grandfather, his brother. And so people would bring tough cases and he would like try and solve them. Like Sherlock Holmes, he really loved that part of it. And I think that's a reason a lot of folks go into at least becoming a physician, but even other parts of healthcare. It's a really neat, interesting part. It's a part that we see like shown on TV shows and stuff a lot. And I really had a sense of like, oh yeah, that is something that it's so special when it happens. And also a bit of like a yearning and sadness because in my day-to-day work, it's not like every single patient, it really feels that way. It's interesting that a lot of the medicine that I do as a family physician is either diagnosing things that I see a lot. So maybe they don't feel as like cool or special or like different, or it's like things that we are sort of cobbling together a name for, or the diagnosis that it says in the textbook actually doesn't quite fit the story. And so there's something that feels less satisfying because you want to be able to just like turn to the answers at the end of the book and say, yes, I got it right. But also it means that we don't have to be confined to the answers in a book. Like, what do we know? What can we discover together with the patient in front of us and kind of co-create what we want to call it? Like, there's also a bit of a freedom in that. And listening to Uncle Jack talk about how much he loves diagnoses, I reflected on how little of my day-to-day work is that. And I'm just comparing and contrasting that may very well be a reason that for many people in healthcare these days, they feel less satisfied than if, you know, they always got to see the pathognomonic thing that was like, ooh, like a lot of us, that is that interesting thing that got us into healthcare. And it's not always what we're seeing day to day. Instead, we're doing forms and diagnosing people with colds. That's obviously not all we do, but you know, it can feel that way sometimes. So that was a piece that really hit me. I loved hearing about how many greats would it be? Great, great grandfather, I think, how he like invented a whole telephone network for his community to make his job easier. I just, you know, from my dad's side of the family, and really just my dad, I know I already have a lineage of like medical technology innovation from my dad's side, but it's neat that even from my mom's side that like we also have that as a lineage of like, how can we make our job easier? Let's invent something to make it easier. And I feel like that's something I very much connect with, and that is a way I think, and I'm very interested in approaching system problems in that way. I'm not like a coder, like not in that case, but I like looking for pieces of technology that can help me. And I actually think this coaching work and this podcast work I have discovered is my technology for making my life easier, even though it is more sort of in the social emotional realm. This is my contribution actually. So I felt very connected to that particular Dr. Morton, Dr. Glaister, that family member, creating his own telephone network. I thought that was really cool. And then the last theme that I thought of that came up both with Uncle Jack and Susan was like the inability to retire. I see that a lot in members of my family for sure. And I love thinking of it not simply as a medicine thing, but sort of maybe just a family trait on the Dobson side of the family. And how that part of it is when you do find something you love doing, why would you stop even if maybe you're making less money at it? And other times it can feel maybe more like a trap of like, oh, my vocation is my identity and I've lost my identity without it. And I'm not speaking for either of them of which of those is part of the reason they've continued doing it. But like I can relate to, you know, I think to my future and what I want to do with my time as a working person. And I can imagine a time where I would no longer feel like I had the capacity, energy, or interest to practice medicine. I'm not planning to do it till the day I die, as long as I get a long life, you know. But I think there is something about understanding what's at the core of what you do for work and love, and never letting that go, even if it takes different forms as you evolve and maybe officially, quote unquote, retire. I can relate to that being probably what happens for me. Will I still be doing this podcast when I'm retired? I don't know. That would be many decades from now, hopefully. But I can imagine still doing some kind of speaking work, volunteer work. Like, it's neat to think of, they're sort of reflecting on, in some ways, their legacy, having retired, and reflecting back on their careers. And it put me in a mind of thinking of my future self and what kind of legacy I want to be able to describe at the end of my career, and even what I want to be up to beyond the job, like post-retirement. So I offer those themes to you in case they're inspiring, and what they bring up for you. I invite you to reflect on what they bring up for you. And I would love to hear if you heard other themes in what was shared from my family members. If you come from a medical family, I'd love to hear your stories. So as always, you can reach out over Instagram or through my website. You can email me. I'd love to hear how this episode impacted you. It feels like a extra special, vulnerable one to share. And yeah, I hope you found it as meaningful to listen to as I found to create. So with that, thanks as always for listening, and talk to you next week. I would love to take this work deeper with you. Visit joanchanmd.com today and discover my growing menu of options for restorative medical education to suit your learning needs. I offer one-on-one coaching, customized workshops, and self-study courses that allow you to connect not only with my work on a deeper level, but also with other healthcare humans just like you. So if you want to start humanizing your work in healthcare to a deeper level and do it in community with others, please visit joanchanmd.com and find those options and what fits you and your life today.